This is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live, and I am happy to say that Jerry Gillies is back, and Jerry is a performer, is a writer, is an ex-convict, is a teacher, is a guru in so many areas. He has done so many things and lived life so fully that I asked him back because last time there wasn't enough time to talk about a couple of things that interested me. One of them is, what do successful people have in common? And that is something that Jerry talks about. Yes, well, I'm going to ask him to do that in one of your books, right?
Yes.
In Money Love?
Well, I talk about it in Money Love. I also talked about it in my book, Psychological Immortality.
Okay.
Which was about using your mind to extend your life, because a lot of the same people who live long, fulfilling lives are usually quite successful, and famous artists and conductors.
Well, let's just start right in there, because I've got some other questions for you and things I want to ask you. So talk about what successful people have in common. Just dive right in.
Well, actually, the one common denominator that I often use was an answer to a question I asked one of my friends and mentors and someone I interviewed a lot for that book on life extension, Norman Cousins.
Oh.
Norman, of course, had worked for and knew personally 8 U.S. presidents. He was a close personal friend of Albert Einstein, Albert Schweitzer. I mean, just the list is astounding, because he had been the youngest editor of a major magazine for some 30 years, the Saturday Review, before he wrote his best-selling book, Anatomy of an Illness, based on him curing himself of a terminal disease by watching funny movies and discovering that laughing released endorphins, and he pioneered a lot of the research in endorphins and, yes. And what the
brain
secretes.
Well, that's going to be a wonderful segue, because I want to talk about humor next, in light of the fact that you are a stand-up comic and just performed at the Berkeley Marsh. But so just briefly, at least, say
all
what
right,
they
so
have
what,
in common.
What I asked him was, what do all these famous people, mm-hmm. successful people, at the very top, masters of their chosen fields, what do they have in common, if anything? And he said, well, you know, they do have something in common. Most mornings, they wake up with robust expectations.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I love that phrase.
Of themselves and
of
the
how
world?
The day's going to go.
Ah.
In other words, and I tried to live with that model. Every day, wake up expecting something wonderful to happen. Of course, there's a saying in the whole New Age movement, expect a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
But I really do. I expect mm-hmm. some wonderful news to arrive, some new and exciting person to show up, a terrific phone call. And I notice a lot of people get up and they hardly make it out of bed and they're already having negative expectations.
So, but you're making an interesting point, which is kind of subtle, maybe not, that these expectations, robust expectations, don't have to be for totally life-changing events.
Well, they can be small things.
Right. So that's important because there are, I believe, there are those small, wonderful things all around us all the time. And maybe it's a matter of being open to them and seeing them when they hit you in the face.
Like I met a woman and we had some things in common. We're going to be discussing some collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
And she announced that she had been trained as a gourmet cook. And I put out a subtle hint that I love home-cooked meals.
That you've been trained as a gourmet
cook. So I now have robust expectations. She's going to invite me to dinner.
Uh-huh.
Now, see, it doesn't matter if it happens.
Yes.
I'm enjoying the robust expectations.
Yes, I understand that. Yes.
If a meal happens, that's another happy event
uh-huh.
on top of
yes,
it. And if it doesn't happen, that's a momentary disappointment.
So that's important, that you have to know what to look for and be open to it.
You have to be reasonable in your expectations.
Yes.
But you can be a little, I think you should go a little beyond what's probable for good things to happen.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, some people are programming themselves, when we're talking about life extension, to live to about 80. Sometimes they'll say 90. Well, that's a limitation, too.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that biologically,
you mean given reality, that's a limitation.
Well, given the biological opportunities, mm-hmm. we can live to 120 right now. And a number of scientists have said that will be expanded to 150 within the next 20 years. So if you can hang in there for 20 years.
And you're planning on it, I know.
Oh, I'm planning on a 150th birthday
party. I know
party.
That. We talked about that. Can I be on your list?
You can be on my
list.
In other
words, will I be
invited?
But
you have to do your part.
No, I understand that. I'm hoping to. I'm hoping to.
Everyone who shows up has to have done their part.
Yes. Now, if we fail to do our part, or if it doesn't work out, you know, God forbid.
Maybe I'll light a candle at the party in addition to the 150 on the cake.
Can we bequeath the invitation to our children and grandchildren?
I'll have to meditate on that. That might get to be a little crowded.
Okay. Okay. And full of people that you don't know.
That I don't know,
yes,
right?
Okay. I want to ask about humor, being funny, which is a topic that really interests me. I've noticed in life that everybody thinks he or she is funny. People think they're funny. Even people who are not, they seem to think they are.
Well, sometimes people who are funny don't know it or think
That's
it.
True. That's true. That's the deal. I'm laughing at you, not with you.
Right. Yes,
what,
absolutely.
Well, talk about, if you would, talk about your performance. Now, what was that like?
Well, the performance
because
was
you're gonna,
actually...
Because you're going to be doing this in Panama, Matt.
I'm gonna going to be doing stand-up in Panama, the first English-language stand-up comedian in Panama.
That's great.
Maybe in all of Latin America. I don't really know if any have gone down there. And it's a challenge, and I've done some stand-up comedy. I'm more familiar with the writing of comedy, which I've done for a number of years. The stand-up's just within the last year or
so. How did that go?
Well... It went very well. I performed at the Purple Onion, the famous club in San Francisco.
Oh, so when was that?
It was I think it was in August.
Oh, just recently?
Just quite recently.
Oh, you know, you say the Purple Onion, and I think of like 1962.
Well, it was big then, and it came back, and it recently changed locations, but I was one of the last performers there before it
Okay, so this is in San Francisco.
The old one.
Where is it located?
On Columbus.
Oh,
it's no longer there. Yeah.
And now?
I'm not sure. I haven't kept up.
Oh,
with
I see.
Its
you mean even since you were just there.
Oh, just in the last few weeks, it's changed.
Okay.
But in any event, that was stand up. Then I performed just even more recently, within the week, at the Marsh in Berkeley, and the Marsh is probably the premier showcase for. Solo performance, one-man shows, one-woman shows.
In San Francisco and in Berkeley.
In San Francisco and Berkeley, two theaters in each location. They put on 700 different performances a year.
I did not realize that. I'm a fan of the Marsh because I've been there for Charlie Veron.
Oh, yes. He's amazing. And
so
a lot
funny.
Of the performers are amazing
I'm
and
sure.
go on to major fame in New York and all over the world, really. And so it's quite a prestigious place to perform. And I was doing a 25-minute piece that was part of an evening called Tell It on Tuesday, which was about storytelling, which was a new experience for me because that's a whole new kind of theatrical presentation where people tell stories. And there are courses on storytelling and their performances. But what I did was because I was going to Panama in a few months and performing there, I wanted to have a piece that I could show people in Panama. So at the end of my 25-minute piece, I did five segments about my life. I did four about my past life, and I did one about my future life as a stand-up comedian and as an expat in Panama.
And that's the part that I saw on YouTube here.
Yeah, that was the first one I uploaded to YouTube. I'll probably put the others on there shortly.
But, I hope so.
But it wasn't totally or strictly stand-up. It was an extension of the storytelling. So it wasn't quite as fast-paced, getting as many jokes in as my stand-up material.
So the difference then is stand-up focuses more on the short and getting to the punchline.
Getting to the punchline. And it's different than solo performance, which is not necessarily always funny. Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting you ask that. I love getting laughs. Because laughs is an amazing sense of power because you're getting a visceral reaction, physiological reaction from the audience that is not necessarily their choice.
It's your
when they
choice.
Applaud, they're choosing to applaud. But when they laugh, sometimes they can't even control it.
Oh, that's such a good point.
Yes. And so it's almost like being God for a moment, which is why so many people get into comedy because there's that rush. Mm-hmm. Also, it can go terribly wrong, easier than solo performance or anything else. You do a wonderful piece of acting in a solo piece or a theatrical piece, and chances are you'll get consistent reaction most of the time. But in comedy, you could do exactly the same stand-up routine one night, and then another night, and then another night, and get three totally different reactions.
Okay, so my other question before we started this was, I want to talk about what makes a good audience, because I'm sure that plays into what you just said.
Well, I wish I knew, because I'd only let those people in.
Yes.
I'd have an air taser or something to keep all the others out. There's no way of knowing. I've had comedians tell me, well, you want them a little loose, so you want them to have had one or two drinks, but you don't want them to have six or seven. So, you know,
Them to be, yes, you want them to be able to be attentive.
You want them to get the joke.
Right.
You know, to be conscious.
Right.
But you also want them to feel free enough to laugh.
Now, what does that cost you when you have an audience that's a dud?
Well, it depends on your own self-awareness.
I mean, how do you keep going? That's got to be a little hard.
That's very hard. Suppose you have, say, a half hour to do, or even longer, 45 minutes or an hour. And the first 5 minutes, you know this is a disaster, because you will know that. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep going. Now, there have been famous cases of famous comedians who have just walked off after the first 5 minutes. They couldn't handle it.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
I don't blame them, but...
Yeah, well, it can be devastating. Uh-huh. And comedians are quite often neurotic anyway and have low self-esteem. So if the audience is reinforcing that low self-esteem, they can get panicked.
Why do you think some audiences, I mean, if they're going for stand-up comedy, what makes them...
Well, some people just don't have a sense of humor.
Then why are they going to the stand-up comedy?
Well,
that's exactly my point.
Maybe they don't know that.
That they don't have a sense of humor.
Yeah, I don't think people who are really terrible audiences keep on going to see stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. But you might get them for the first run, the first time they've walked into a comedy club.
Oh, so bad luck.
Yeah, there are a lot of people, a lot of first-timers who go into a comedy club. Or some people just go in with kind of a chip on their shoulder, make me laugh.
I was going to ask about too, yes.
That happens. Or they're there to heckle.
Oh, so that they can be the star of the show?
So they can get attention.
Oh.
Or they'll sit in front so you pick on them.
Uh-huh.
A lot of audience members will sit in the front hoping that the comedian is one that picks on the audience members. He uses them as punchlines.
Uh-huh.
And they could be very disappointed if that doesn't happen. And they could take it out on the comedian. So there are many dynamics going on between the audience and the performer when it comes to comedy, much more than almost any other performance art.
I read an article many, many years ago that struck me, I still remember it so clearly, about the betrayal that people feel when a joke is not funny. And I really...
You mean the audience members?
Uh-huh. Or children, when parents are telling a joke and it's just not funny. You know, you've given yourself over to the person in charge to make you laugh and make you feel that high. And when it's something dumb, you have been betrayed in a way.
Well, it has to do with expectation. Now, if you're successful as a comedian and you have a reputation, quite often you don't have to be funny. You just walk out and they expect to laugh, so they start laughing, even if you have terrible material or are doing a bad job presenting it.
Mm-hmm.
They will laugh because you're the funny guy they saw on television, and so we're here to laugh, and just walking out on the stage, you'll get a laughter response, and they'll keep it up. And maybe toward the end of your act, they'll realize, well, wait a minute, he's having an off night. But by then, it's too late. The momentum has started. So it's an energy force, and it's very much like a lot of other energy forces. I mean, it can be related to success. As you know, I also have had a career as a motivational speaker and workshop leader. Well, there's a lot of the same energy.
Say what that is, if you would.
Well, the energy is, it's sort of like making love.
Mm-hmm.
You're having a connection.
Mm-hmm.
You're having an energy exchange, if you will.
Oh, I like that, because that is what happens between audience and performer.
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And it also happens if you're doing, say, a motivational talk, and you know that they're getting it, that you're sharing something that strikes a responding chord in them, and that they're going to be able to use in their life or identify with what's going on in their lives, and they'll be able to use it in their own way.
So that is kind of brings the point, as I'm listening to you, that you're giving something of yourself. In other words, to be a good motivational speaker or a good stand-up comic or really a good anything, you have to give of yourself authentically. No?
Well, I think so. Although you can be a very polished performer and not give of yourself or give of yourself in a false way. You have that both in comedians and politicians.
Yes, right. I'm excluding politicians because it would
you
be
can
nice
have skilled stagecraft and not be revealing yourself.
Right.
But it doesn't hold up as easily.
That's right.
And if people like you, that's almost, you've already won. Whether you're a motivational speaker or a comedian, if people like you, if they sort of fall in love with you a little bit, you can't do anything wrong.
And falling in love means trusting.
Trusting.
Right.
They're putting themselves in your hands.
Trusting,
so they're going to listen, and they're going to pay attention, and they're going to process it as if they were processing something with a friend that they were having a conversation with.
Which is why I think political speakers now do all that personal stuff, like I'm a mom, and my first coffee table was from the junk store.
If you have one thing that you have in common with your audience member, you've won them over.
Right.
So if you're telling a mother-in-law joke, to go back to a stereotype, and the fella in the audience has a mother-in-law that he's been having difficulty with, he's going to laugh harder than most of the other audience members.
Yes. Yes. And if you are the mother-in-law...
Well, then you probably won't be in a comedy club because you'll have been warned off.
That's so standard, yes. Gosh, audiences and energy exchange, exactly right. So did you want to say more, talk more about your motivational? I kind of disrupted that by going back to comedy.
Well, I think the whole thing about motivation is that you have to tell people the truth, which is usually what you have learned, not in your own experience necessarily. In fact, I sometimes have difficulty with motivational speakers that get up, and I've heard probably all the top motivational speakers, having been for a number of years a member of the National Speakers Association and just running into them at various venues. And the ones who are successful and who I would go listen to are always ones that have paid attention to what's going on around them and what gets people to be more successful than other people. There are things that stand out. And if you can convey that in language that is simple and to the point, what you have noticed makes people successful. But if you come out and you brag about how you have a million-dollar home.
Oh, you see that on television sometimes.
They're scam artists mostly, because I know personally several of these people who are usually broke or bankrupt.
Yes.
But they're always taught. If someone has to tell you they're worth $1 million or many millions of dollars, they're usually not. Now, that's my basic rule of thumb. It may not always be true, but most of the time it's true.
I like your focus on telling the truth, because you can only learn from the truth.
My new mantra...
Unless you learn from such falsehood that you take that as a horrible warning.
Yeah, my mantra in my life, and I like to think I sort of lived that way even before, but now it's more intentionally, is to always say what I'm going to do and then do it.
Oh, we talked about that last time. ABC, folks, has to come up ABC in life or your credit is no good at all.
Exactly.
Your emotional credit, I think, yes.
Yeah, and so you tell the truth.
So one of the truths, but that's true in comedy also.
It's true in comedy. The more you are telling the truth, maybe exaggerated or maybe out of time and place so that it's funny. You know, that whole old saying about tragedy is...
Comedy is tragedy
plus time.
Yes.
And that's quite true. And it's a sense of timing also and what the audience will tolerate. There's a certain point... And this is also true about almost any achievement in life.
What's that?
What the people you are trying to teach or trying to sell something to or trying to influence, what their comfort level is, they will really love you if you take them a little beyond their comfort level. So they're stretching.
Yes.
But if you take them too far beyond, they will be angry. And if you take them really far beyond,
they'll be terrified.
They'll attack you with pitchforks.
Yes.
If you don't take them to even their comfort level, if you go under their comfort level, they'll be bored.
Yes.
They won't get anything out
of
the experience.
That. Slightly beyond the comfort level, because then they can have a feeling, a well-deserved feeling of accomplishment.
Oh, yeah. And
we
all
need that. It's so fair, yes.
And as a comedian or a motivational speaker or as a workshop leader or teacher, I've always tried to go beyond my own comfort level. Because there are times I'll say something, I'll say, well, maybe I won't get away with this. Maybe I shouldn't even try it. And then I'll go for it.
Well, I find the same thing true in love letters.
Oh, absolutely.
Is in workshops, is getting people to say what they thought they weren't brave enough to say. And then once they do, well, it seems so natural. It wasn't scary.
That's true. And one of the exercises that I liked, and it actually developed at Moore University, which has done a lot of work on the male-female relationship and sensuality and sexuality, they have an exercise, and they're similar in other psychological approaches, similar exercises, but it's very valuable, where you sit opposite a person and you say, Janet, there's something I withheld from you. And you reveal something you've withheld. Now, it could be a positive something or a negative, and I found it's useful to do both. To say, here's something I withheld from you.
What would be a negative thing, for example? What would be a negative thing? I can understand what a positive.
Yeah, Janet, you're wearing too much jewelry. It's going to bounce around and make noise on our broadcast.
Which it did, and I took off my bracelets, yes.
Exactly.
I see.
I mean, that didn't really bother me, but maybe on someone it would. So they would share that.
So a negative thing doesn't have to be a hurtful thing.
Oh, no, it could be, constructive criticism. And all you say is, thank you, I know. So you're saying, you know, thank you, and I am aware of that. Whether that's true or not, or whether you really want to say thank you don't discuss it. That's the important part. You don't get into a debate about it. And there are many other ways of
Is that so that you can train yourself to get used to accepting?
So you can get used to accepting and delivering something that without worrying that the other person's going to attack you or spend a lot of time defending themselves. You're letting them know. And I had a relationship where we used to do that once a week. And we would give six things we appreciated and six things that either upset us or we thought could be improved.
I think it's interesting that you do that between, for male-female relationships. Is that not as valuable female
to female
or male
to male? Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. Just in that case, I happen to do it with a relationship partner.
I see.
But I've also done it with business partners or people I'm doing business with. And in fact, my friend Tony in Panama, who I'm going to be involved in a lot of projects with, we do that because sometimes we're totally different people and sometimes we will misunderstand each other.
Oh, yes.
As often happens with any two people are operating together. So he's very good about sharing that immediately and I'm pretty good about that too. And so we do that. We'll say, this upsets me, I wish you didn't do this, and I will say, well, thank you for letting me know that.
I have a question about misunderstanding, because I think, I was talking about this last night with some people, that given that we do so much of our communication via the internet, there is more of a possibility of misunderstanding, because you don't get to hear a tone of voice and see a face.
That's very true. I have a friend who goes off in a snit every once in a while. We have these political debates via email. And he swears up and down he does not have thin skin. But he does. And we have a mutual friend, and the mutual friend says, oh, yeah, he has very thin skin. But he'll go off, you know, if you're going to demean and deride me, I'm not going to share with you anymore.
Well, I had that experience with a friend, and it really brought me up short. She had posted something on Facebook, and I responded to it in a really kind of affectionate, glib manner. And she couldn't
see. Took it the wrong way.
Oh, my goodness. She was so upset with me.
Yeah, people take that information differently.
Mine was just a joke, and I said mine was too. But
how would she know that without the body language?
That's right. And so I realized you have to be extra careful what you send, because you're doing it in just black on white.
And even knowing the person well doesn't always work.
Right.
When you don't have that nuance. Yes. And you can't have that immediate back and forth.
Or see a smile or a twinkle. Yes.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And emoticons don't do it.
No. No. Oh, gosh.
In fact, sometimes they annoy me because they avoid.
Oh, they're so goofy. But I like them kind of sometimes.
Well,
but yes.
You know, sometimes people use them and is he really being funny or is he just.
But at least it's
kind of covering his backside by putting an emoticon down with a smiley face.
That could be. But at least a smiley face will tip you off. I mean, you know, again, it's the human struggle to communicate accurately. Okay, let's just talk about.
Well, I think that's why a lot of people communicate with text and emails, because they don't have to be out there emotionally.
Oh, that's true,
It's a lot harder to get away with that even on the phone.
Yes.
I do a lot of my talking to friends and people I'm in some kind of collaboration with on Skype. So we do see each other.
Yes.
And that's valuable because you can't hide out as easily.
That's right. If your face is there.
Your face is there.
I have a love letters question for you only because I like to end each howdy do here with a possibility. I am thinking, because when you first walked in, I was thinking about your performance and what that is like to face an audience. I would love to do, maybe I should do it, maybe you'll do it, a love letter to the audience. A love letter to a good audience about what you appreciate and what you need and what you actually got. And maybe even a love letter to a not good audience. Because you were just talking about saying the positive and the negative. A not good audience about what you wish they had been, but in some kind of really compassionate way that you understood they couldn't.
Well, it's funny. I have a T-shirt that reacts to sound.
How is that?
It has these bars and like a sound meter, they go up if there's noise. So if an audience is laughing or applauding,
they light up. Oh!
So what I will say to an audience if I wear that and I'm performing is, this isn't for me because I can't see it.
Yes. Oh.
This is to rate you. Are you a good audience?
Well, so then they
And if this doesn't light up, you're not.
But then taking it to the audience.
Exactly.
I would bet that they would do more.
There used to be a comedian that would rate
the
audience. He would. I don't remember which comedian it was, but he would come out and say, "You're being tested. I'm going to rate you at the end of my performance. Whether you get a 6 or an 8 or a 10 is going to depend on you."
But when people see their own feedback, as they say right away, don't they be more positive so they can see themselves rising up?
Well, I haven't tried enough to really know that.
I bet they do.
But audiences influence each other. If there's one person laughing hysterically, the other audience will even laugh at their laughing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's contagious. Laughter is contagious.
Oh, it certainly is. It certainly
so if you're just talking to a very thin, very sparse audience, you don't get the kind of laughs that you get in a packed house.
Right. Yes.
Which there's always somebody that will get the joke in a packed house, and it can be infectious.
Yes. I understand that. So maybe you'd consider 2 letters and then mail them to yourself.
Well,
I like the whole business of mailing letters to yourself.
Yeah, that can. I do that once a year, actually.
Do you?
Oh, yeah. I decide what is going to be my life a year from now. What will I look back on as successful? And I'll write the letter as if it's happened.
That's nice.
So I'll say,
do you have those?
Yeah, I usually keep them, yes.
Good. Oh, thank you for doing this with me. It's always just so nice to listen to you. And
well,
I wish you luck in Panama. I hope you make visits back.
Well, I may do that if anybody can afford to bring me back.
Well, maybe somebody will.
My price will go up.
Good. Good. Robust expectations.
Absolutely.
Thank you, dear. Well, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye until next time. And please remember that there are so many ways to write love letters and make somebody happy, including yourself, from you to you. So until next time, bye.